When I was growing up, my mama always told me, if everybody else is the problem, you have a problem. Let me say that again. Mama's great advice, if everybody else has a problem, then you have a problem. She was trying to convey to us that the idea, you know, of you having a problem, everybody else having a problem, she always said, beware the person who thinks everyone else is stupid. Beware the person who thinks everybody else has a problem. Those are words to live by, I guarantee it. The second thing my mama used to tell us is we moved a whole lot, and my dad was in the oil business, and he was a landman. And so wherever the pipelines were going to go or wherever they were going to be pumping oil, we would go first, and then he would buy the land, and then he'd have to go back and make sure everything got put back like it was before. You know, that's not, I know everybody thinks that's a new environmental thing. Actually, back in the 50s, they were doing that. And my dad would have to go, if they destroyed a sequoia out in Arizona, it cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars for every sequoia that they even moved, let alone if they destroyed it. And so, and you paid for it at the pump. Anyhow, so my daddy would do that, and we would move quite often. Every time pipelines moved or things like that, we moved. And so I lived all over the Western United States and up in Canada and different things. And so when we were moving that much, you got to find something good about moving when you're a kid, because you know it's like, oh, time to move again. And so in that process of moving a whole lot, I remember one time we were trying to find some good things about this particular move. We weren't really wanting to make the move. And so I said something to the effect of, well, the good news is I won't have to put up with, and I said this kid's name, anymore. And my mom looked at me and she's like, what are you talking about? And I just said, I said this kid's name again, and I talked about how I couldn't wait to get away from him. I'd never have to see him again, and I was so happy about that. And my mama looked at me and she said something that she'd said many times before, but that time it stuck. And she said to me, she goes, well, you know, the problem is that wherever you go, there you will be. There you are. Wherever you go, there you are. And what she was trying to tell me in a really nice way was that, you know, whenever everything else is somebody else's problem kind of thing, well, the same is true that if everybody, when you move away, the reality is that you take you with you. And so if you're naturally a disgruntled, unhappy person, guess what? When you get there, it'll happen all over again. And if you're the person who always finds himself in the wrong crowd, moving crowds doesn't change that, because you're the magnet. Before long, you just look up and there you are again. It's the same group of people, different names, different faces, but it's really the same group of people. And so the only thing that we understood, and my mom was trying to make us understand, was that the only thing you have control over in terms of attitude and actions and everything else is you. You need to look in the mirror and deal with that, whether you want to or not, whether you like it or not, no matter what you like or don't like, whatever you see in the mirror, that's you, and that's what you've got to deal with. As we're looking today at Israel's reactions to the problems around them, you see, the journey that they're about to go through in the wilderness is very difficult. But in large part, the reason it is so difficult is it's self-inflicted. I once heard it said this way, the difference between Jesus' 40 days in the wilderness and fasting and Israel's 40 years in the wilderness eating manna can be summed up in that whole little thing of how they reacted to that. Wherever you go, there you will be. So I want to take a moment and dig into Exodus chapter 16. We're going to read verses 1 through 36. And we're going to talk about that difference of between the 40 days and 40 years in the wilderness, and talk about how we find our way through the wilderness by dealing with us. Exodus chapter 16, beginning in verse 1, it says, and they set out for Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin. Boy, I bet they didn't know it was going to come out like that in English. Anyhow, and who is between Elim and Sinai on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt? And the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness, and the people of Israel said to them, Would that we would have died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us into the wilderness to kill the whole assembly with hunger. The Lord said to Moses, behold, I'm about to rain bread from heaven for you, And the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, and that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as the gathering, the daily gathering. So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, "At evening you shall know that this was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. In the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against the Lord. For what are we that you grumble against us?" And Moses said, "When the Lord gives you evening meat to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your grumbling that you grumbled against him, what are we? Your grumbling is not against us, but against Yahweh." Then Moses said to Aaron, "Say to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling." This ought to be a hint. So as soon as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation, the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, "I have heard the grumbling of the people of Israel." Notice how many times we keep running into that word, grumbling. "Say to them, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and then you will know that I am the Lord your God." So in the evening, quail came upon the cover and covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay on the camp. And when the dew had gone, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground. And when the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "Manna, what is it?" For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, "It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather it, each of you. You can eat as much as he can eat. You shall take one omer according to the number of persons that each one of you has in your tent." And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gave much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. And each of them gathered as much as he could eat. And Moses said to him, "Let no one leave any of it over till the morning." But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms, and it stank. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered it, and each as much as he could eat. And when the sun grew hot, it melted. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers each. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a solemn day of rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake, boil what you will boil, but whatever is left over, lay aside. It'll be kept till morning." So they laid it aside till morning, as Moses commanded them, and it did not stink, and there were no worms in it. And Moses said, "Eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you have gathered, but on the seventh day, what is the Sabbath, there will be none." So on the seventh day the people came out to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, "How long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath, and therefore on the sixth day he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain each of you in this place, and let not one go out of his place on the seventh day." And so the people rested on the seventh day. Now, the house of Israel called it manna. It was like coriander seed, white and taste. It was like wafers made with honey. And Moses said, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer of it be kept throughout the generations, so that you may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you up out of the land of Egypt." And Moses said to Aaron, "Take a jar and put an omer of manna in it, and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. Lord commanded Moses." So Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. And the people of Israel ate the manna 40 years till they came to a habitable land. And they ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan. And Omer is a tenth part of an ephah. And so now you know, because I know you were wondering what an Omer was. And now you know, it explained it right there. All questions answered, right? Okay, well anyhow, actually, you know what? Can I get someone to do me a great big favor? And would somebody grab me a cup of water? Because I am struggling with a cold, and I could really use a cup of water. Thank you. Well, you know, here's the thing is that when we look at this whole situation, you know, as we get into the kind of the details of it, at the heart of it is this whole issue of Israel complaining, just, constantly grumbling and complaining, carrying on and on. Thank you so much. And, when you think about it, Israel, as I've said many times throughout this series, is just learning who God is, just like everybody in this process. They are not any more wise to who God is than the Egyptians are, because they don't have the books of the Bible yet. They've been living in a captivity. They've been there 430 years. If you want to just keep that in perspective a little bit, you know, we haven't been a country 430 years. It's a little over 200 years as a country, and yet, and we come from all different lands. There's not a one of us in this room that I'm looking around that I believe, I could be wrong, there might be somebody, surprise me, but that we're not native to this land. This is not our native land. And yet we think of ourselves first as Americans. You might say, well, I'm Irish, or I'm German, or I'm, you know, African, or I'm Latino, or whatever else. But here's the deal. At the end of the day, we all call ourselves Americans. We have a common culture, an expectation of society and things like that. We are Americans. And you know what? They were Egyptians. They were Israelites, but they were really Egyptians for all intents and purposes. 430 years is a long time for a culture to get absorbed into another culture. So that's who they were. And they're learning about God. They know in one sense we're Israelites, we're the people of God, and that we're different. But they really didn't know how they were different other than things like circumcision. You know, there was really no significant cultural differences in the way they conducted themselves. So they're finding out just like Egypt was finding out. And those tests, those things that Egypt went through, and the 10 plagues and all that, they were getting an education in that process. And along the way, they began to believe God. And so they started doing what God said, including when it came down to the last test. And he said, paint your doorpost with blood. And what did they do? They went and they painted their doorpost with blood, because they figured out it by this point, when God says it, he means it. Or you die. That's a great motivation. In fact, it was such a great motivation that it tells us that a mixed company left with them. That is, that some of the Egyptians said, ha ha, I've seen this, I played buffet before. We've been through this enough times now. 10 times. I may be slow, but I'm not stupid here. We're going to paint our doorpost too. And they got kicked out of Egypt as well and had to go with Israel. And they cast their lot with the Hebrew God. That's a good thing for them. But along the way, they've just been learning the same lessons. And there's every indication that they're starting to learn the lessons. But they end up out in the wilderness and they're up against a rock and a hard place, or in this case, a sea and an army, and they're ready to go, and they start to fear, and is there no graves in Egypt that you brought us out here to die? God delivers them again, opens the waters, destroys the army of Pharaoh, and they see one more time how God delivers and God provides. God is on their side. You think by now they might have a clue. I want you to think about this for just a moment. If you saw a sea open up, and the ground was dry, and when you got through, the sea closed and wiped out your enemies, might you think that God is on your side? How many people think that maybe God was on your side if something like that happened today? You know, just thinking. Okay, what about if the people who are oppressing you, like whole waves of frogs started coming out of the river, out of the Nile, and overcame everything? Or what about that all their cattle would die, and your cattle were good, and nothing happened to your cattle? Do you think that might get your attention, make you think that maybe God is on your side? I mean, they had every reason. 10 times they've watched God work in their favor. Now out against the sea, they've watched God work in their favor. They're learning lessons, but here's the deal is that Israel is kind of thick. And now they're saying the exact same thing all over again. Ah! Oh, is it... Yeah, well, couldn't we just die by the flesh pots? Couldn't we just stay where there was bread? They'd rather be in bondage than be free. You know, one of the things that, you know, when they respond like that, that it draws my heart to is, I remember that when my wife and I were on our honeymoon, we'd just gotten married, and I'm not from Minnesota. I'm from Texas. I didn't know how cold it could get in some places, and so... Everybody said to us, oh, you know, a great place, just, you know, you don't have a lot of money, you can't get away to Cancun or something cool like that. You know, just go a little bit north, you know, of here, and you can go to Thunder Bay, Ontario. There's gorgeous waterfalls, and it's roaring and loud, and it's gorgeous. Just go out up there. Do you know what? Those just roaring falls don't roar in January. It was so cold, the oil froze in the car. And when I called the guy and I said, hey, can you help me out? I've got a 75 Volvo. And the guy started laughing. He goes, you must be a Yank. And I went, why'd you say that? And he goes, well, first of all, he says, you have a 75 Volvo, and nobody in Canada has a 75 Volvo. They didn't come to this country until just a couple of years ago. And second of all, nobody is dumb enough to have gone last night without plugging in their car unless they're a Yank. And I was like, thanks, I'll just be right down to pull you through the phone. And I was like, oh, gosh. And so long story short, we had to call back to Minnesota, and I had to call the seminary and say, well, we weren't going to be there, and we weren't going to, you know, be able to be at classes. And I had to call into work and say I wasn't coming into work, and Don had to call. And we just made all these calls, and every time we called somebody, their response was like this. Sure, you're on your honeymoon, and you forgot to plug in the car. Sure. Because you know why? They're all from Minnesota, and they know you have to plug the car in. But see, I'm from Texas. I didn't know. So I, you know, I'm like wondering, hey, honey, you know, like, did you know you were supposed to plug in the car? No, because when she got it, you know, went off to college, she forgot all about it. And so oil was froze. There was not much we could do about it. And all kinds of goofy things happened. But here's what I know is we didn't have a whole lot of money. And spending more time in Canada where pizza was like $50 for a pizza, And we were broke, and we didn't have the extra time or the extra money, and we needed to get back, and all these pressures were on us. And we were kind of stressed out. It wasn't all the fun that we wanted it to be, except for being locked in the, you know, a cheap hotel. You know, I mean, that was not a whole lot of other advantages on a honeymoon. Nothing to go see. You know what? Not once did my wife ever say to me, I wish I'd died rather than be stuck like this, not much food, ducky hotel room. I'd rather die in my nice room back home. I'd rather die than been able to go to Taco Bell freely. No, she never once said anything like that to me. Can you imagine in a brand new relationship, what if she had said something like that to me? What if she had looked at me and just said, I'd rather die where there was plenty to eat and a nice bed than to be here with you? Of all the hateful things that a person could say. See, Israel's not just grumbling, they're hateful. God has been providing for them and done for them, and the first time that they don't know how they're gonna solve it, well, we don't see any food around us, we'd have rather died and had something to eat. They're a mess. Israel's tremendously ungrateful to the point of hateful. That's the situation that's happened here is, you know, that they can't see anything good in it. No matter how many times God has delivered them, no matter how many times God has come through, the first time it gets difficult again, well, you just, man, I just wish I died than be here with you. And there's no ambition on their part. They're not doing anything about their situation. They're just kind of complaining. But, you know, the sad thing for me in this whole situation is I read that text is not how awful they were, but the reality of how dangerous a ground I would be standing on if I was to sit in judgment of them. You see, while we have nothing to compare in the 21st century to the misery that they experienced in their lives, I'm aware that we complain incessantly. Sometimes we call it posting on Facebook or Twitter. Other times, you know, let us get a bad meal and we do it on Yelp. But, you know, here's the deal is that when you read people's vents on Facebook, have you ever thought to yourself, save the drama for your mama? And you think, boy, I just can't believe they would. They think nobody knows who they're talking about? I mean, what is this? But you know what? Here's what I know about the people of Israel. They're not bad people. They're really not bad people. In fact, the thing that upsets me the most is that they are very ordinary people. People like you and me. I can't judge these people. You see, they are not faithless as we would like to count faithless. They are faithless even as we are faithless. Let me say that again. They are not faithless as we would like to count faithlessness. They are faithless just like we are faithless. You see, the reality is that when they were in their difficulty of their situation, they did what most of us would do. They complained. They went on and on incessantly because all they could see was what was immediately before them. You see, one of the things that strikes me always is the contrast between Jesus' 40 days in that wilderness and their 40 years. There's no lack of hardship in the time that Jesus was in the wilderness. I mean, forget manna and quail. He was fasting for 40 days and 40 nights. I think that's why he went out there alone, because if I went 40 days and 40 nights without fasting, I can't imagine I'd be good company. No, I don't really think that's why he went out there by himself, but here's the deal. He was fasting. His conditions were hard. And yet in the midst of it, he had to do the same thing that you and I would do in the midst of difficult trials and circumstances. He had to trust God. You see, he was fully in the flesh as well as being fully God. And he didn't blame God or say stupid things like, aren't there enough graves in Egypt? Or, you know, I wish I had died rather than be out here with you. Instead, when he was tempted, he trusted God. Hebrews chapter 4 tells it to us this way. It says that he was tempted in all the same ways as we are and yet was without sin. When you look at his temptation, you might be tempted to say to yourself, that's not temptation. When did I ever stand on the pinnacle peak and have the opportunity to throw myself down and let the angels catch me? Okay, number one, don't try it. Number two, your temptations and trials are different than mine, aren't they? The things that tempt me aren't the things that tempt you. The things that tempt you aren't the things that tempt me. I can guarantee you that I have never, ever been tempted to have an extra serving of beets. I can tell you, if you've ever had that temptation, we do not share the same temptations. I have, however, been tempted to have another scoop of coconut ice cream. That, man, you know, now you're talking great temptation. No, seriously, we have different kinds of temptations, each one of us. But the thing is that what we're battling against is the flesh. And Jesus had to, by the leading of the Holy Spirit, make the same decisions, not to give in to his temptations, to make decisions to do what was the Lord's will. The difference between a reaction and obedience, you see, a reaction is when we act against, and action is when we choose willingly to do the things that we know are right. When we operate out of a set of values and shared ideas and common understanding that transcends our circumstances. And the world around us is full of being controlled by its circumstances, reacting in the heat of the moment. That's how we have wars. That's why we have the rumors of wars right now over in Europe. That's why people do the things they do to one another in the heat of reaction. That's where sin breeds its best. But the reality is that for you and I, that the place where we find our strength in God is in values and the things that we believe that transcend the heat of our circumstances, the heat of the moment. We're not situational ethics people, and yet, oftentimes we function out of that same kind of modality. You know, we start thinking just like the whole rest of the world, and we just want to respond to the things that are happening right now rather than being intentional, trusting, and obeying the Lord. You see, when Jesus was in the midst of all of that, he said things like, man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. He said, when he was tempted to worship and to find the shortcut, he said, it says to worship the Lord your God only, and him only shall you serve. He was quoting back the word. He found his place of where he found his compass, if you will, in the word of God and in the being in the people of God and the company of God, not in the heat of the situation that he was in. He didn't let those circumstances dictate how he would respond. You see, when Jesus was hungry, he was really hungry. Either that or you and I put our faith in something that's really empty. You see, because it says he was tempted in the same way as we are. So I've got to believe that that means that when he was fasting for those 40 days and nights, that he really was hungry. In fact, that's why the enemy came to him at that moment. He said that he was hungry and he wanted something to eat. And that's when he said, hey, turn these stones into bread. It was a real temptation that Jesus really resisted out of a matter of who he had his confidence and trust in. And Israel Israel was serving the same God. And even, not even in the equally difficult of circumstance. And yet they just reacted. Aren't there graves back in Egypt? I'd rather die than be out here with you. Huh. Significant difference in the way they acted. I really believe that the difference in those 40 years and the 40 days was the response to God in the midst of their trial and their circumstance. You see, and they got to the promised land pretty quick, actually. When you follow the rest of the story and you read through the book of Exodus, you realize it didn't take them that long to get there. And when they got there, they once again didn't put their trust in God. Instead, what we read is again and again and again, grumbling and complaining. Every circumstance that comes their way, they don't go, "Oh God, we're so glad you're on our side, and would you help us solve the situation?" They go, "Oh, couldn't we have just died back in Egypt?" At one point, God is about to give them their wish. They're grumbling and complaining about wanting to die in the wilderness, and God says this to Moses, "You know what? Move out of the way, and I'm going to wipe out all of them." Now, he can put up with Egypt for a whole year and through 10 major trials. He can put up with Israel in the land of Israel for 200 years of listening to the prophets about points of repentance. But he's not making it 40 years with these guys because he's already had enough of all their grumbling and complaining. They just cannot see what is right in the middle of any of this. Their trust is not in God. They're not putting any hope in God. They are just, every time something comes up, it immediately goes right to that same response every time. Oh, I wish we would die. You ever seen a kid do stuff like that? You know the kid that collapsed in the grocery store and like falls down dead and wails and everything, and everybody walks by going, "Glad that isn't my kid." That was Israel. That was Israel. You know, see, it wasn't the long route that took 40 years. It was dealing with their attitude and their lack of obedience, their way of reacting to everything that God did, everything that God didn't do. I mean, it just didn't matter. They just complain and complain and complain. And so God finally just said to Moses, "You know what? I'll tell you what. You move out of the way. I'm going to wipe these people out, and I'll make a great nation out of you. I'll just start right over." Moses said, whoa. That's exactly what everybody's saying about you, God. Don't do that. It wasn't really God's intent. God was expressing his frustration and his disappointment. You ever dealt with the frustration of and pain of someone just complaining about everything you do? God had had enough. He almost gave them their wish. Wish that we'd just been left to die. But God didn't. No, God continued to work with them and brought them to a place of growth and maturity, and they eventually seized the land. Didn't mean that they didn't ever have difficulties again, but you see, attitude and reaction is the exact opposite of trust and obedience. And when I look at their attitude and their reaction and how it arose out of their lack of trust in Yahweh, and I look at the trust and the expression of Jesus' heart, that how he trusted the Father and he obeyed him, even when the circumstances were difficult or he didn't fully understand what was coming next. Even so much so that Jesus would say in the Garden of Gethsemane that he would kneel down and he would pray and he would say, "If this can be taken from me, then take it away." You ever thought about that? That Jesus, in his flesh, wanted that to be taken away. You see, Hebrews tells us that for the joy set before him, he endured the cross and shame. But it didn't mean he was looking forward to the cross. It meant he was looking forward to what it would do for them, to the hope and to the promise of salvation. But he wasn't looking forward to the cross. But Jesus, in his flesh, subdued the will of the flesh, and outside of his circumstances, opted to trust and to obey and purchased for us our salvation. It's quite a difference from reacting and complaining. and you look at those events. 6 days of manna, it only takes, how long should it take for you to gather after 5 days that every time you gather extra, that it's going to turn to worms? I don't know. I think that probably once one batch of manna turned to worms, I'd be thinking to myself, do not gather the second, handful. Okay, don't leave any over till morning. I get how they could make the mistake day one out of fear or something like that. I think they should have just listened from the beginning, but I can see how out of fear that they might have gathered extra, and then when it turned to worms and went, okay, this didn't work, but the message has to be said over and over again to the point that Moses has to become angry with them and go, what are you doing? Day six, hey, gather twice as much this time. Now, here's my thought. If for 5 days you've been given some specific instructions and every time you didn't keep those instructions, it went bad for you, why on the sixth day would you just decide to just opt out of the instructions and do whatever you want? I can't imagine. That's what they did. They gathered. Some of them didn't gather any at all. And they were like, hey, whoa, time out. I'm hungry. Well, I guess this is your day of fasting and prayer to work on your attitude. And to come into compliance with what God's doing in your life. I could see why maybe the first Sabbath that they doubted, but why would they keep doubting? Why would they keep kicking against the goat? On one occasion, on the occasion when God gives them quail. I don't know about you, but I don't eat a lot of quail, but man, oh man, when I get some quail to eat, that's a pretty good pickings. I like quail, man. If somebody ever said to me, hey, Hal, you can eat your weight in quail today, I'd be all signed up for that. I'd love to have all the quail I could eat. And these people just are never, ever satisfied. These same people complained about Egypt. You know how I know? Because it says that God heard their grumblings and he came to be their deliverer. Have you noticed a trend here? They complained when they were in Egypt. They complained when they're in the desert. They complained when they're in the wilderness. They complain when they're up against the sea. They complain when things are going their way. They're complaining when they get manna. They complain when they get quail. These people just never stop complaining. Now the problem is neither do I. I know you're not like me that way, but not too long ago, I sat down and I was looking at my prayer journal, and I was looking at my prayers, and I got to one whole section where I realized that for just entry after entry after entry, there was all this grumbling and complaining, and God do this, and God do that, why does this happen, and all, and I was just so caught up in my own little stink, and I was reading through that, and I was like, what in the world am I doing? And so that morning, as I started to write in my journal, I just stopped. I didn't ask for anything. I just spent the rest of the day writing out in that prayer journal over and over again everything I was grateful for. And wherever it came up again during the course of the day, I wrote in there some more, and I just started to stop and think about what I was becoming if I continued down that road. You see, there's so much to be grateful for. I was a missionary in Mexico for a while, and one of the things I always was impressed about my neighbors in Mexico was how happy they were, even though they had so very little. I was just always intrigued. I mean, nothing was more exciting than a cold bottle of Coca-Cola on a Saturday night. Many times my neighbor's big attraction was sitting. They would grab their chairs and open the gate because everybody lives behind locked gates because there's nothing. And they would go sit out in the dirt road in front of our house, sit in those plastic long chairs, drink their Coca-Cola, and it was the best thing in the whole world. I watched it holidays, and one of the things I was always honored, people usually got, when they get their paycheck at the end of the week, they get meat that first time of the week. Because most of the time they didn't have meat in my neighborhood. And they would go get meat. You know what the first thing they do is they'd invite me over. We're going to have the missionary over, have a good time. We're going to have meat for dinner tonight. And so they'd share it with me, that little bit of meat. I always felt really bad. I always try to bring extra stuff. And, the thing I knew is that they were really grateful people. It taught me a lot about gratitude. Something, a lesson I still think I have a whole lot more to learn. But I, you know, what the deal was is it wasn't their circumstances that made them grateful. It's the simple recognition that God was working on their behalf regardless of their circumstances. You know, there's not enough that you and I could ever have to ever make us grateful. Yesterday I had a chance meeting where I was out handing out some stuff, and we were doing an outreach, and I ran into a guy that heads up pantries in this area. And he was talking to me about how that they're actually cutting back on doing some of their serving of food and different stuff because they said that they're just, they don't know, they said there's so much glut of food. He said, we just, at this point, we are turning down truckloads of bread every day because we can't give it away. He says, if you go hungry in Hernando County, he says, man, it's crazy. There's such an abundance, such a glut of food, and there's so many people doing feedings and things like that. And I was like, really? And I was this eye-opening moment. He goes, but you know, the thing is not everybody wants what we're given. Yeah. It's amazing how ungrateful we really can be. Israel was learning what we all should have learned by now. That when you get to your future, there is no way that God isn't there with you. There's no future that you are headed into that God isn't there with you. And as Israel was moving forward, you see, they didn't put their attention on God. It never at once did it say, God, we're in a difficult situation. Can you help us out here? It never once says that they say that. What do? They turn to Moses and they go, weren't there graves back in Egypt? Like, what have you done to us? You see, they never put their eyes on the Lord. And continually, Moses will have to say to them, you're not complaining about me. You're complaining about the Lord. It's the Lord who provides. It's the Lord who does these things for you. You get to the water, if it's not even drinkable, the Lord makes the water drinkable and changes the water from bitter water into sweet. The Lord is continually providing for you, and all they can see, all that they can see is what they don't have, what they didn't get. And they're always thinking to themselves that God is going to disappoint them. See, they didn't trust Him. Really, the difference between the 40 days and the 40 years really is that issue of trust. They had to be taught to trust God. And you know, the thing is I realize in my own life that a lot of times the situations and the difficulties that I'm in and everything else, that one of the biggest things that's the blockade is me coming to a place where I will trust Him regardless of the circumstances and believe that He is good and surrender. The old song, you know, we used to sing, but it's still true today. Trust and obey, because there is no. That's where we find ourselves, just in that place where we have to say, God, I do not always understand. And just like Jesus, sometimes I'm at the place where I want to say, let this cup pass from me. But just like Jesus, I have to say, but nevertheless, your will be done. I trust you. I believe you. I have confidence in you in those moments of difficulty and trial and hardship that you will not leave me or forsake me, and that there is no future that I can go to that you will not be there with me. That I believe the best about you. See, because in the end, no matter where you go, no matter who you run into, no matter what the circumstances, the reality is that when we get there, there we will be. And if everybody else has a problem, even God, chances are I come to this place and I say, God, help me. Could you help me? You see, I want to do what Israel didn't do. I want to come to the place where in that moment, whenever all those circumstances are flooding in, when I'm tempted to complain, when I find myself in that place where I don't know how to move forward one step, that I'll do the one thing that Israel didn't do. See, because I'm Israel. I know who I am. I look in the mirror every day and I know who I am. And if I don't want to be Israel, then I know that the solution is when I come to those places and all of me wells up inside, that I have the choice to do what Israel didn't do. God, help. I believe you. I trust you. I have confidence in you. God, I really would love it if you would take this cup from me, but no matter what, your will be done. You are this morning? Are you in the place where you would say to the Lord this morning, gosh, God, I catch myself in that place. I, just like Israel, I've seen your hand at work in my life. I've seen so many blessings, and yet I find myself continually complaining, rehearsing my pain and my sorrows, and not trusting. So today, Lord, I would do just, I ask you to do in me what you wanted Israel to do. Would you bring me to that place where I just surrender and just say, I trust you, I obey. I don't always fully understand it, but God, I believe in the midst of my circumstances. I believe that my future is in your hands, that the best is yet to come.